Mugbyte. My name's Gavin Clark, software editor of The Register.
Hi, and I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of the All About Microsoft blog.
And this is a special seasonal edition of Mugbyte, not just about turning the year, but also the turning of the decade. One thing's for sure, it's a different Microsoft that's leaving the decade that entered it. The year 2000 was a safe, comfortable, secure place for Microsoft. It was a client world, a client server. It was a world of closed source, predominantly for the company. By 2009, Microsoft's grappling with open source and, as ever, trying to design some kind of successful internet strategy. In this show, we're going to look back at the last 10 years. We pulled out three of what we think are the biggest meta issues that defined Microsoft and also challenged it, and what they mean for Microsoft and, of course, its customers and partners. We'll be talking platform shift and reset, from the cozy bit of .NET and the glory of Xbox to the debacle of Windows Vista, and how they paved the way for Windows 7 and possibly to Windows Mobile 7. Security, remember Slammer, Code Red, and I Love You from the early 2000s? Well, they shook Microsoft's confidence, some would say its complacency, and that led to a procedural and a coding shake-up at Microsoft when it comes to the way it builds Windows. Finally, the web. Microsoft spent a decade trying to figure out the internet, and Microsoft still can't get it. It woke up late to the Google threat, and then spent half the decade trying to catch it up by throwing loads of money into an online strategy, also trying to catch up to Amazon and to Adobe. The jury's still out on Microsoft's work, while those leaders are already moving on to other things and fresher fields. So, MJ, platform shift and reset. It certainly was quite a safe, familiar world for Microsoft when it entered the 2000s to where it is now. What are the highlights, and how did we arrive at Windows 7, and what's in store for Windows 8?
Wow. Okay. We could do a whole book on that. But when I've been thinking about the past decade, I was thinking about it in terms of Windows releases, because I'm very attuned to what they're doing with Windows, and Microsoft still is the Windows company. Mm-hmm. At least for this decade, they are. So if I think back, I remember 2001 is when they launched Windows XP, which became the biggest and best-selling Windows ever, which I'm sure at the time Microsoft didn't think was going to be the case. 2004, they launched XPSP2, which, you know, at the time they called it a service pack, but in hindsight, that was really a whole new release of Windows, and it was meant to address some of those earlier code security violations that you mentioned that we'll talk about in the next segment. Then we have Vista. Man, we could do a whole Harvard set of case studies on how that went so wrong. But when I think about that, I think back to 2004, which was kind of right in the middle of the, as it was called then, the Longhorn development cycle. And you probably remember this, Gavin. In 2004, Microsoft did something that people have come to call the Longhorn reset, mm-hmm. which was Microsoft basically going back to the drawing board and saying, okay, we can't do what we just said we were going to do. We're starting over. And from then on, it was just a much less ambitious version of Windows that they were working on and what came to market in 2007 as Windows Vista. And now here we are in 2009. Microsoft launches Windows 7. The Vista debacle sort of ends now, and everything supposedly is all right with the world, right? So it's been a rocky decade for them in the operating system front. Especially when you think about on the financial side of the house, how things have changed so much for Windows. I mean, at the start of this decade, Windows was the by far and large biggest cash cow at Microsoft. They could do whatever they wanted pretty much on Windows. And that's what the whole DOJ antitrust trial was about, which a lot of people have forgotten about, but actually is falling into this decade as well, because the actual ruling that came down on the Microsoft and antitrust trial around PC OEMs happened in 2000. That was the kickoff of this decade.
Yeah. And that was such a pivotal moment. I mean, everything about that case spoke to Microsoft's control of the PC operating system world and what a kind of monoculture PCs were. Linux hadn't really happened. The web was still very much in its early days. So it really did speak to how much Microsoft was the gatekeeper on the desktop and how it could make OEMs jump through its tune in terms of shipping or not shipping rival browsers. Yep. I thought an interesting looking back on the last 10 years was how Microsoft just completely fluffed what should have been its core competency, which was building and delivering versions of Windows. I mean, through the 90s, everyone was talking about the reliable release track of a version of Windows every 3 years. Well, with Vista, obviously, that fell apart. And I never seen, again, never seen this spectacle before of actually a company removing, Microsoft in this case, removing the features that it actually promised, those three big pillars that were promised by Bill Gates at PDC 2003 of, was it Avalon, Windows, became WPF, Windows Communication Foundation, and WinFS. But two of those came in one form or another. WinFS was ripped out entirely. So it really was. You wonder what happens inside a company when this should have been its core competency. And skipping forward, here we are, of course, Windows 7 just shipped. Safe to say, it's a safe operating system. It's, you know, Microsoft learned from its from what happened with Vista, and decided to be a whole lot less adventurous, and that's how come we arrived at Windows 7. And I wonder what you think, MJ. What does it mean about Windows 8? I mean, there's a lot of discussion out there about the commoditization of the operating system, and how these things are fundamentally not interesting. But where does a company go now it's delivered the safe but boring Windows 7, the safe but boring Windows 8, and how do you get people to move?
Yeah, I mean, if you use the Office team as kind of the benchmark, which is really what we should be thinking about, since that's where Steven Sinofsky, who runs Windows, came from. If you look at what does Office do, they do very predictable, safe, regular upgrades of Office. They don't try to bite off too much. They really make sure when a big beta comes out, it's done pretty much. So I have to believe that Windows 8 also is going to be a fairly small and not overly ambitious release of Windows. Mm-hmm. But that said, maybe that's a good thing, because as exciting as it was when we first heard about Longhorn and .NET and everything being managed code and like, wow, this is going to be a whole new world, they couldn't pull it off. And so I think customers and partners would rather see something less ambitious, but at least safe.
Yeah.
And I think that's what 8 is going to be.
And I spoke to customers at a recent user conference for a management software company called Case, and I polled a couple of customers. I said, well, how can Microsoft screw it up with Windows 8? Because pretty much they were all mopping their brow with Windows 7, saying how they'd avoided Windows Vista deliberately because they didn't want to be martyred. They thought users were so angry at it. And they said to me that essentially just deliver a safe, reliable operating system, and don't also, when it comes to features, don't deliver features that lock other people out. So everything plugs and plays very nicely with Windows, because there was a time where if you had to plug something into Windows, another vendor's sort of hardware device or piece of software, you had to require a whole separate set of tools to make the two work together. Because in today's world, everything has to be interoperable. Everything has to be like, as Balmer would say, super interoperable, because you can't afford to lock people out or turn people off just so they pick Windows over some other operating system or your applications over some other a piece of software. You have to give people the choice. So again, Microsoft is, yes, they delivered Windows 7 safely, but so much rides on Windows 8, and yet they've got to make it exciting and useful to businesses without excluding people through subtle tie-ins and lock-ins.
Yeah, I think the other point is they shouldn't tie people in, but they also have to make sure they're backwards compatible. And, there have been a lot of calls over the years for Microsoft to finally just do what Apple did and say, okay, we're going to break compatibility now. And if, we're doing this for your good because we're changing the core of this thing and we're going to make it better, but we're going to break compatibility starting at this date. Apple could do that because they have a smaller user base, and I think there'd be a lot less outcry with them doing that. Microsoft needs to do it, but I think they are scared to do it because of the huge outcry that would bring. And we saw that a little bit with people trying to move from XP to Vista and XP to Windows 7. I mean, a lot of things break as far as applications, custom line of business applications. A number of companies who were their longtime partners said they weren't going to do drivers. So I think that's one thing I'm watching for in Windows 8 is how do they solve the backwards compatibility conundrum? Because that's going to keep coming up and keep haunting them. And I think what they're probably going to do is do some kind of a thing with virtualization. The way they offer XP mode with Windows 7, I think they'll probably take that a step further with Windows 8 and make sure that they have something for every user so that backwards compatibility is assured, at least through virtualization. But that's just a guess on my part.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a piece here. One of our guys, Tim Anderson, sat in a session with Mark Rusevich, and he talked about the underlying complexities inside Windows 7, which is something nobody's really talked about. So it would seem the mission for Microsoft going forward is to make the OS even simpler, to get away from some of this complexity and these DLL lock-ins that they seem to have carried over, and that I think is a legacy of the past architectures of Microsoft. But it was interesting, just talking platforms, just briefly, the biggest platform, or two of the platform departures for Microsoft for the 2000s, one was Xbox, and the other was Windows Mobile, which kind of carried over from the 90s with Windows CE. Xbox, tell the two platforms really, Xbox, stratospheric success, mobile, not so.
Right. I mean, it's funny to think back on Xbox. I remember when Microsoft launched the Xbox and Xbox Live, the gaming service with it, and everyone said, they're never going to catch Sony. This is stupid. Why are they throwing all this money at this? And, you know, Sony's got the market locked up and it's over. Game over, you know. And now look what happened. They actually managed to catch up to Sony. And now they're trailing in some other areas, but and trying to catch up to Wii these days. But it's funny to see, like, when people say that about Bing, too, which we'll talk about later, you know, it's like, why are they going to try to catch Google and search? It's impossible. It can never be done. Okay, well, will history repeat itself? Maybe it can be done, maybe it can't. But Microsoft does know how to keep kind of fueling the fire and building the development community and finding ways to give stuff away that other companies charge for. And they don't care how much money they spend. When they set their sights on a market, they're going to either buy their way in or get their way in somehow. So when people write them off in some of the new ventures they're in, I'm like, don't write them off. They'll do anything to get the market share.
I mean, that's a very topical point you raised there. I mean, we've seen Palm get thrashed by Microsoft, and then you just say Sony has lost market share to Microsoft as well. And obviously the road is littered with people such as Novell with Windows NT when they took on Novell's network. You wonder that, I mean, has the game changed since then? Back then, Microsoft would go with a business unit at Microsoft would go with a single focus after one company, and it could be Novell, it could be Sony, it could be Palm, and often those companies suffer from a combination of arrogance and complacency and old world thinking. But now the front it's fighting on, especially with the internet so broad, you wonder, you know, does it have the resources or the focus to actually repeat that success of the past?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the proving ground is going to be Windows Mobile. Yeah. Because, man, I don't know about you, Gavin, but I am getting tons of reader questions about, is Microsoft still in the mobile business? Yeah. And aren't they going to get out of this business? They've lost. They're done. You know. And I was talking to a Wall Street analyst this week, and he said, do you really think they can save themselves in mobile? And I said, well, you know, they said they put all these big stars at the company on the mobile team and that they have all these big plans. He goes, so you're telling me no? You don't. I'm like, well, I'm not actually saying no, but I am going to be really interested to see what rabbit they can pull out of their hat here, because wow, they really have done themselves in here even worse than they did when they didn't come out with a new version of Internet Explorer. I mean, they have lost their entire reputation in mobile at this point.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, we're going slightly off topic but the decade will be marked by a number of misbets on Microsoft's part, such as the decision not to release another version of Internet Explorer and just sitting on its ass, basically, with Windows Mobile and expecting users would come to it rather than it have to go to users. And you saw, you know, the rest is history, basically, because Apple came along and hoovered a lot of people up as a result of that. So some interesting and curious platform decisions were made during the 2000s by Microsoft that were basically extremely short-sighted, it seems.
Yep, I agree.
So another hot topic was security. And I don't know if people remember, but the start of the 2000s was we were inundated with worms. Nobody had really heard of worms until Windows XP shipped and the later versions of SQL Server and Internet Explorer and Outlook, obviously. And suddenly we had Slammer, Code Red, the I Love You virus. All these worms were going through your code. There was a story once with Slammer, I believe it was. It was supposed to have shut down a nuclear power station, which had everyone on the edge of their seat and like diving from the side of their desk. And then, you know, I Love Your View, nobody wanted to see that coming to the inbox because basically it kind of like chewed its way through your address book and sent on, it proliferated itself by emailing all your friends, anyone you had dealings with. So I think it was an interesting concept because I remember at the time Microsoft introduced its latest operating systems, and as ever with Microsoft, these are the most secure, most reliable operating systems we've done, you know, as the latest, most secure version of Outlook, and yet this happened. And I think it's fair to say the company entered the 2000s in a sense of not really not knowing or anticipating maybe some of the dangers that lurked out there of connecting up its client server based software to the internet, and people pounced on it. I mean, those virus writers and hackers really pounced it. Microsoft's experience of the 90s was denial of service attacks, you know, NT servers being taken out and denial of service. But, you know, the 2000s was a whole new ballgame, and I think Microsoft had to radically review the way it built code and also the code itself. And, you know, that led to Bill Gates' famous, or some of the same first, trustworthy computing memo, which said, you know, how we're, you know, we're going to get better and some of the changes that were introduced to the processors. Now, skipping forward, it's fair to say, I mean, you know, I'm not going to give Microsoft a free pass. Now, a lot of people will probably, like, write in and say, you know, oh, you know, Microsoft. But they have got their security game together. The company that leaves the 2000s, leaves its code, leaves the 2000s in a much more secure way than when it entered through. And because it got a trial by fire. And, you know, it's releasing regular patches. I think the proving point was Vista. And everyone was expecting Vista would get slammed by hackers because it introduced the new security model with the secure kernel. But I think everyone was surprised because the attacks that we thought were going to happen, that were obviously inevitable, never really materialized en masse. I wonder what you thought about that, MJ.
Yeah, I actually do think they have gotten better. And I think they've also managed to convey a message. Some people believe, some people don't believe it, but I tend to believe it's true, which is, you know, Microsoft does get attacked a lot, and IE and Windows get attacked a lot, but in part that's because they're successful and it's lucrative for hackers to attack them. I mean, at every hackathon you hear about, you know, when hackers just have all the different platforms in front of them and they try to break into them, the first one that gets broken every time is the Mac. And, you know, I hear so many Apple users saying, well, it's because the Mac is more secure. That's why they're not attacked as much. Well, actually not true. It's because if there were more Mac users, there'd be more viruses for the Mac. I think Microsoft managed to get that message into people's heads. And some, like I said, some believe it and some don't. But I think they have gone a hugely long way into securing Windows, Internet Explorer, and their other products. Like, I mean, security by design is part of their credo for everything they build now, and everything has to pass all these security tests. They know they can't have more things like Slammer and all those viruses hitting products today because people will just switch. Now they have a choice, and they'll just dump it and say, forget it, you know? Mm-hmm. The other point I thought was interesting around security when I was thinking back about the past 10 years was this is kind of a little-known fact, but it tells you a lot about what was going on at Microsoft. When Windows XP SP2 came out in 2004, you know, they released it as a service pack, and the reason they did that was because they wanted everybody to upgrade to it and not worry that it might be incompatible or a new version of Windows or anything like that. But it really was a new version of Windows, and the reason they introduced it and called it Service Pack 2 was because it incorporated a lot of things to security hardened windows. And I mean, they could have called it something like XP Advanced Security or something, which would have freaked people out and they would have postponed deploying it. But by 2004, they knew at Microsoft that they had to do something really radical and quick to secure Windows and IE against all these attacks, or they were just going to be hopelessly enmeshed in these kind of constant barrage of viruses and worms and everything else hitting them.
Yeah, definitely. I think they learned a lesson. I think something else that was interesting, you know, without being too kind of Microsoft, of course we can't. It's not our job, marketing people to do that kind of stuff. User account control, still hated by a lot of people, and still a lot of people scratching their heads over it, and still a lot of people wondering why they bother with it. It's the kind of system you can't seem to get right. You either make it too flexible or too Stalinist in its approach. And I know we've written stories about how out of the box Windows 7 is still highly vulnerable to a lot of viruses. I think it's worth pondering what exactly happens to user account control in the future. Can you ever build a security system in Windows that relies, you know, where users are doing stuff and setting the privileges and leaving themselves vulnerable? And is that possible?
Yeah, and then the other question is, you know, do users even really know what they want? If you remember with Vista, UAC prompts were like so invasive that people turned off UAC and basically took the risk of unsecuring their systems. But, you know, then when Microsoft was developing Windows 7, they were going to have similar UAC prompts throughout the system. And there was so much outcry that they reduced the UAC level in the operating system. Mm. Next thing you know, people who are security experts are complaining that Microsoft has made UAC ineffective, and it's useless at this point. So, you know, how do you find that happy medium, you know, where you won't have something so annoying that everybody's turning it off, but at the same time that it actually does something and isn't just like a rote question that comes up and it's not actually securing your system at all?
Yeah. I think one thing Microsoft learned its lesson from the 90s and through the 2000s is not to ship products where you have so many controls open by factory default. And one of their cultures is, well, their core culture has been to empower people. So they want people to do lots of stuff with operating systems. But as we learn with things like people downloading stuff off the internet, and there is a need for something like UAC in a way to actually protect people from themselves. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, that's Microsoft's fault, it's bad Microsoft, they should build more secure stuff. But, you know, who's doing the downloading at the end of the day?
Yeah, we'll see what happens with the products going forward. You know, I was interviewing somebody in their systems management team recently, and we were talking about Windows 8. You know, and Microsoft's not ready to talk about Windows 8 yet, but they're dropping little hints here and there. And one of the things they did drop some hints about was how can you make Windows more secure by tightening up systems management and to kind of work at it from the Windows update side of things. So that could be interesting if they can find another way of securing it that's not directly in the OS itself, but that somehow has to do with things being downloaded to you and their patch mechanism or their security mechanism through the web. Again, like I'm being really vague because I don't know what they're going to do there, and I'm not sure they know what they're going to do there yet. But it's something they're looking at, like could you secure the operating system from outside of the operating system and not just inside?
You can do so much in terms of securing online, but it's a tough, you know, it's a basic rule of security engineers, you're always a step or two behind those writing the vulnerabilities. So yeah. Can you ever proactively secure? We'll see. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the one thing they, towards the end of this decade, they did do that, actually this year, that they're getting a lot of positive feedback about is a successor to OneCare, which is Windows Security Essentials, the product that was codenamed Morrow. And, you know, when they first said they were going to do it, there was a lot of outcry like, oh, Microsoft's going to do a security product for Windows and it's going to be free and it's going to be dumb, you know. I mean, everybody was like, oh, it's going to be lame, it's going to be horrible. And then when people started trying it, they're like, actually, this is pretty good. It actually works and it's not intrusive. It's a lightweight client. And, you know, I'm sure Microsoft's former partners who are now their competitors, like Symantec and Norton, aren't that keen on them doing a good job with something that's now essentially a free product for anybody who has a genuine copy of Windows. But it actually is a good product. And, you know, the idea behind Microsoft doing a free product in the space was there's a whole slew of users out there of Windows who aren't willing to pay for security software. And so all their PCs are basically insecure platforms that can be taken over by bots, and then they can infect other people's PCs in the organization. Mm. So the idea was, let's at least just throw a free thing out there so people have just some level of coverage. And it's actually turned out to be a good product. I'm using it on my own PC, and I'm really pleasantly surprised with how good it's been.
Well, we all know you're in the pay at Microsoft, Mary Jane.
Well, you know, I was using AVG free, you know, so I was using another free product before this, and I didn't care whose product I was using, but I just wanted something lightweight that wasn't like dragging my system down. So I have been very pleasantly surprised. I was not expecting it to be a good product.
Well, one thing we were expecting Microsoft to get right was an internet strategy, I think, wasn't it? I haven't more than 10 years trying to figure it out. But it turns out they can't. Apparently, they need more time to do it. How would you define the last 10 years Microsoft when it comes to the web, apart from being asleep for the first 5 years and then waking up late and trying to buy its way up a hole for the last 5 years? The company let Google build up massive market share in search and advertising. It's allowed Amazon to establish a foothold in terms of hosting applications for people who are considered one of its core constituents, developers. And Adobe continues to dominate the web in terms of media, video, and audio content. And as it's spending money and time trying to catch up with those. Now, I know that we've now got Bing as far as search goes, we've got Azure as far as cloud goes, and I challenge you to pronounce Azure any other way, Mary Jo. And Adobe's challenger is now going to be Silverlight, which hits version 4 next year in 2010 after a very rapid development cycle. You know, lots of stuff going on, and yet, you know, jury's still out, isn't it? It's a lot of unproven here.
Yeah. I mean, to me, when I think about, you know, Microsoft's, I agree with you completely first about, wow, they've been all over the map in the internet space in the past decade. But the kind of the turning point for me, like the time I start measuring, like what they really did was 2005 when they hired Ray Ozzie. Mm. And I'm not saying Ray Ozzie has changed everything there, but you probably remember he wrote this thing called the Internet Services Disruption Memo in 2005. And it was kind of like when Bill Gates wrote the Internet Tidal Wave memo, and that whole thing happened in the 90s. Like, oh, wow, we missed the Internet, and now we need to fix that. This Internet Services Disruption memo to me is like that. It was Ray Ozzie coming in with some fresh eyes and saying, wow, you guys are missing the boat on the Internet. And here's how you need to fix it. And he like listed all of Microsoft's divisions and said, Windows should do this, and Office should do this, and Tools should do this. And if you look back, they've done a lot of the things he said. And that's why there's been such a flurry of activity in the past 5 years when it was so quiet before that. Mm. So that's an interesting data point, I think. It's like, okay, they started getting serious around 2005, which I'm sure most people would say it was pretty late in the game. Now, the other thing I think has been interesting to watch on the internet front is kind of what's happened with Internet Explorer over the past 10 years. You know, I mean, it was the whole point of the late 90s trial in the U.S., the antitrust trial, was Microsoft and the browser bundling thing. And here we are in 2009 again with a different trial in the European Union with Microsoft and the browser bundling thing. Yeah. It keeps coming up and yet Internet Explorer is still technically part of Windows and ships with Windows. But that isn't even guaranteeing them anything anymore. You know, in the past, you'd say, okay, that's why they have 90%+ of the browser market now that they've killed Netscape. They own it. But look what's happened in the past decade. They're down to like 60-some-odd% in the browser market. Mm-hmm. And that's from a variety of factors, I'd argue. I mean, I'd argue that their competitors are really strong and they have some good offerings like Mozilla and Google with Chrome. But it's also because of kind of the missteps Microsoft's been making. I mean, IE8, as I've said numerous times, it doesn't run very well on XP. And, you know, that might be Microsoft's plan, make it really not run well there and then kind of coerce people to upgrade to Windows 7 where it runs better. But they've made so many missteps with IE at this point. It's like, wow, you guys got to fix this going into the new decade because browsers are becoming more and more important. I mean, look at Chrome OS. It's a browser with Linux underneath, you know. And if Microsoft doesn't figure out IE and fix that whole strategy, they're really going to be hurting in the coming decade.
They are. They are indeed. Yeah, it's interesting to see where the browser will go. As we said earlier, they made a massive strategic misstep in deciding it was game over as far as browser development goes. I think the interesting thing is the transition kind of brings the debate back to where we started from, was the move to development and cloud and online. You know, the Amazon, who would have thought Amazon would end up dominating what came to be known as cloud computing, at least as a hosting environment for developers posting their applications, which is something Microsoft never anticipated. And it was interesting that they finally launched their Azure cloud recently at PDC in LA, and yet it's still not complete. And when you strip away the bits that they've taken out again, the .NET applications have gone. What you've got is an application computing environment and a storage environment, which is precisely what you get with Amazon. And Amazon, on a pricing perspective, still undercuts Microsoft's cheapest option because Amazon runs Linux. It doesn't run on Windows. So there's a lot of light points here that are kind of will continue to challenge Microsoft, at least as far as building an online strategy goes. I mean, I know people would say, well, Microsoft will never be able to beat Linux because you have to pay for Windows, but you never have to pay for Linux. Microsoft, it seems, will try and argue the quality argument for the next 10 years, saying, okay, Linux might be free, as Amazon might be cheaper, but you get the applications from us, you know. But we've got to see those applications and move on to the Azure cloud before people will actually take it seriously.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're going to start seeing really what's going on with Azure when people actually have to start paying for it, which is next February 2010. You know, up till now, there have been a lot of like test apps and people trying it out and Microsoft tinkering underneath with the platform and taking parts out and moving parts around. We still don't know what they're going to do with the quote-unquote private cloud and how that's going to work. They just say, don't worry, you're going to have a capability of moving stuff between the public and private cloud. Mm. Well, we don't know what the private cloud is yet for Microsoft, and we definitely don't know what the strategy and the technology is for moving from one to the other. So those are all things you got to be curious about as they go forward with Azure.
Absolutely.
And that's how I say it. I say Azure.
I believe you're pronouncing it incorrectly. Final word on this. Flash Silverlight, I mean, what do they do? They're wrapping up all their applications online in Silverlight, and yet Flash, I mean, it dominates the web. What can you do? I mean, it seems to me the best avenue for Silverlight when it comes to Microsoft Online is pitching it at the Microsoft partners who'd rather not use Flash, because it seems that Flash is beyond ubiquitous. It's one thing to say Microsoft comes at rivals with its angry eyes on, such as it did with the Novell in the past decades and, you know, other companies. But, you know, how do you take on something so viral and so penetrated as Flash? I don't see how Silverlight can do it. It needs to focus, it needs to bite off what it can chew, which in Microsoft's case is appealing to the Microsoft partners who would rather not use Flash.
You know what else I think they could do, and you're starting to hear little hints of this in what they're saying. They could, if they play their cards right or wrong, depending on how you look at their strategy, they could turn Silverlight into the Windows development environment. Like right now, it's the web environment for running your apps and developing web apps, right? But what if they totally replace Windows Presentation Foundation with Silverlight, which is kind of what they're hinting they're going to do as they add more things like COM to Silverlight, COM support. If that happens, then Silverlight doesn't just become like a browser plugin that does what Flash does. It actually becomes way more. And if you're a .NET development shop, then it won't look so weird for you to develop for Silverlight because you'll be used to kind of the paradigm and the tools and the technologies. And it And then maybe you could just somehow turn your Windows app into a web app, or have two that are actually compatible and not two totally different things. So maybe that's where they're going with Silverlight, why they think there's more potential for it.
It'd be an interesting debate. I think that'd be a subject of internal politics inside Microsoft. I know from
yes.
my here.
Yep.
And let's not forget, Silverlight came off as an offshoot of WEF. You know, lightweight version, cool, sexy, hip, and now it could end up eating the thing that gave birth to it.
Yep, I bet it could.
So, long decade, as decades go, Steve Ballmer, he emerged from the shadow of Bill Gates as the big man at Microsoft, and as Gates went off to spend more time with these viruses. So, Ballmer, his decade, it's been quite a ride for him. What do you think? How does he end the decade, MJ?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, Gavin. Like, if you had asked either of us at the start of this decade, do you think Steve Ballmer will be running Microsoft by the end of 2009? I know I would have said no, and I bet you would have too, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Gates' retirement was a pretty big surprise, and Microsoft really managed it well, I have to say, because they really made people believe there was no disruption and everything was the same and nothing changed. But I would say Ballmer, you know, he started off kind of in the shadows, as you said, at the start, but now he's out there in the front, and a lot of things have changed in terms of Microsoft's dominance and the market and how what's important now to customers and partners that, you know, 10 years ago weren't as important to them. And I think Ballmer has not fared very well. And that makes me a little sad, because I actually am a fan of Steve Ballmer, and I think he's done
I knew it. That comes through in all your reporting, MBA.
Well, okay, here's why I'm a fan. I'll say that. Whenever somebody says, toss Ballmer, he's a bum, I always say, okay, and who would you like to see as a CEO of Microsoft?
Mm.
Would you like to see Steven Sinofsky or Kevin Turner? Or, you know, the new guy, Stephen Elop, who runs the business division. So until somebody has a good answer and something that really makes sense, and I go, okay, yeah, that would be a great choice, I'm going to keep saying I want Ballmer, because I think I can't think of anybody who would kind of shepherd the company the way he has. And that doesn't mean I think he's done everything right, as we've talked about on this podcast, but I don't see anybody else ready to step up if any of those other people stepped up, I'd be like, wow, they are done. They're finished, you know? And I know I'm not portraying a view that everyone believes, because there's a lot of calls for Ballmer's head among shareholders who are mad the stock price has stagnated for most of this decade. And they feel like Ballmer's out in left field, you know, betting on Bing and pouring money into things like Health Vault. They're like, what are they doing? You know, they're all over the map. But until somebody comes up with a better suggestion, I gotta say, okay, if you you gotta back the guy until you come up with somebody better.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they need to have an alternative candidate. And often in these succession battles, as I've seen in Silicon Valley, there isn't an alternative candidate. That you get rid of the current guy, then you look for a replacement. Microsoft without Ballmer, he's somehow, you know, it's a tough job being a CEO, and also it's an eccentric job being a CEO, because you have to like wheel together all these separate strands within the company. And he certainly is an able spokesperson for the company. I would say he's possibly an outstep spokesperson, especially when it comes to open source. And when he opens his mouth, the open source community shudders as all rolls their eyes and say, well, what do you expect? It'll be interesting to see how far he can change in the next 10 years, and whether this grassroots seepage of open source culture and the internet that's coming into the server and tools division can genuinely permeate up into the organization and turn him into a less of a combative CEO and less prone to making the kind of inflammatory statements in open source that have riled people during the last 10 years. So, bringing that all home, what do we reckon? What's his? How does Steve-O leave the decade, MJ? What's his mood?
I'd say he's probably a little frustrated. Not frustrated enough to throw a chair, but definitely not the happy-go-lucky developers guy we know and love or hate. I think he's got to be very focused right now on going into a really tough decade. I mean, we didn't even touch on this, but Microsoft's CFO, Chris Liddell, just quit. And now they're having to put a new CFO in. And I'm sure it's very disconcerting right now. It's a tough time to be there and convince people that Microsoft's still relevant going into the new decade.
Yeah, definitely. I think he's got a lot on his mind. I'd be frustrated. I'd be certainly intense. He's put a lot of money down on those bets needs to pay off. And it'll ultimately be the shareholders who will decide his fate, whether individuals or institutional. And those will be the guys to decide whether he's done enough or gone too far.
True.
Well, that's it for this year. For this decade. I'll see you in 2010. My name is Gavin Clark, software editor of The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog. And this has been MicroByte, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.